Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Brexit Podcast. For today's episode, we are joined by Gina Miller, who is best known for bringing the successful Supreme Court case against government, forcing the Prime Minister to go through Parliament to get approval for triggering Article 50 and setting Brexit in motion. You can listen back to Episode 9 if you want to hear more about that. But for now, she's also challenged government over the £1 billion funding for Northern Ireland that Theresa May promised the Democratic Unionist Party in return for them securing her a governing majority. Gina's here to tell us a bit more about that and her general thoughts on how Brexit has been going this far. Welcome back to the show, Gina.
Hello.
Great to have you back on. Just to start off with, could you tell us a bit more about your challenge about the DUP deal and how that came about?
Well, over the summer, I've been looking at the details. I've looked at Hansard and all the details on this payment to Northern Ireland that's connected with the DUP agreement. And nowhere could I find that it said subject to parliamentary approval, which would be the norm for this sort of payment. And when you look at this as an exceptional payment, it would need to come under a number of different ways and processes that the government could pay for it. And this, they would all require the government to put something before Parliament. And because we couldn't find anywhere, I was very concerned that they would probably be using the prerogative power or the Henry VIII powers to bypass Parliament. So on the 7th of August, I sent a letter off via our lawyers asking the government, how do they intend to progress this payment? So it wasn't about the agreement. It was actually about the payment itself. And to my surprise, they answered and said, no, we were absolutely right. It would need to go before Parliament. And then that threw up even more questions, because on one hand, you had senior members of the DUP saying they were expecting a payment as early as October. And yet I knew that there was no parliamentary time for a vote and to go through Parliament. And in that letter that the government sent back to us, they also acknowledged or stated that there was no timetable. So none of this seemed to add up. So I came to the conclusion that the only reason they had responded to us to say that they needed to do parliamentary approval was in response to our letter to stop us from going to court for judicial review. So to my mind, this is yet another example of this government putting itself above the law, bypassing Parliament, and using our public money to keep themselves in power. And everything about it just stank.
So you think if no one had pointed out that indeed this does need to go through Parliament, the government would have just sort of swept it under the rug and gotten it through without parliamentary approval?
I would suggest that, because I can't see any evidence to the contrary. And the two main things would be it would need to be approved by Parliament and be timetabled. And it's not timetabled in this Parliament, which is quite a disruptive one because of the conference season. And secondly, cross-party, speaking to different MPs, nobody seemed to be aware of this. And even the DUP themselves, as I said, senior members were saying that they want this payment as early as October. And there was no chance whatsoever that they would have been time to put that in the what's called the Estimates and Supply Act, which actually doesn't come to an end until March 2018. So there is no evidence that we could identify, or I can see, which proved that the government were actually going to put this to Parliament.
And I'm assuming that you're not suggesting that it wouldn't necessarily go through Parliament, but rather that it's about having that procedure in place, whether it gets approved or not. Yeah.
No, it's about the scrutiny, because you have to remember, this is coming from public money. This is coming at a time when we've got a government saying there isn't enough money to increase public sector pay. This is a time when we have austerity. This is a time when they're saying that our stretched services in England, Scotland, and Wales can't get any more money, and yet they've magically managed to find £1 billion for education, NHS, deprived areas in Northern Ireland. Well, what about the rest of the Great Britain? Why do we not have that same sort of extra money? So there are lots and lots of questions, and these are the questions that need to be asked in Parliament in a debate before a vote goes through.
Since we're talking about scrutiny, just last week a motion was passed that will allow Theresa May's government to replace EU legislation once they're taking over into UK legislation with the Great Repeal Bill, and sort of amending them or abolishing them without them being voted on or debated in Parliament. More specifically, they've sort of pushed through the motion that they have the majority in the Committee of Selection, which will be responsible for scrutinising EU legislation. So apparently, according to The Independent, this plan to take control of this committee was set in motion right after the general election when May realised that she wouldn't have a governing majority to push through her agenda. So from what I know about you and the fact that you sort of really value proper process, and going by the book and going up based on the two challenges that you've brought to government this far, this seems like something that would concern you.
I am very concerned with both the way that the committees are being, you know, stacked in favour, if you like, for the government. But I have to say it's not an unusual practice, because other governments have done it in the past from differing political parties. I think the whole system needs to be reviewed. But in your first part of that question, when you talk about the Great Repeal Bill, or the Withdrawal Bill, as it's now being called, it's not some laws, it's all the statutes that will come onto the UK books, if you like, onto our law, legal books, and then the government will decide. Now, I am very disappointed that the MPs have not asked more questions about this, because in the 66 pages of this bill, there are only two lines that talk about Brexit. The rest of it is about the repatriation of powers and legal and law. And what's very concerning is the breadth of, if you like, scope that this government are giving themselves in the Henry VIII powers over the next 2 years, all in the name of Brexit, saying it's so complicated, we can decide on our own without scrutiny from Parliament which laws are kept and which are got rid of. And that can include workers' rights, maternity rights, disability rights. You know, there's a lot of concern here. But secondly, you've also got the fact that the lots of powers that would normally go to the devolved administrations are actually coming back to Westminster as well. So there are many, many things about this act that need to be gone through in a line by line. There's still an opportunity at the committee stage and furthermore, but I don't believe that MPs stood up enough cross-party and questioned the nature of this bill and why the government is giving itself such wide powers.
This power grab that a lot of people have been talking about, do you think there's anything that can be done at this point to sort of prevent it, or to sort of rein it in a little, or is it sort of a free-for-all for government at this point?
Oh, no, it's not a done deal by any way. There is committee stage is when I hope that the, as I say, MPs will go through this bill line by line. But also then when it gets to the House of Lords, that the Constitutional Committee there and the House of Lords as well ask questions, because the House of Lords is an oversight house, and their job is to ask again and say to the lower house, think again about these issues, think again about this bill, and I hope that they do that. But committee stage is the next one, so it's not a foregone conclusion that this bill will get through. But there are many, many questions to be asked about it.
Now, we are speaking before Theresa May's big speech, so this could all be thrown up in the air. But this far, I'm assuming you've been following negotiations. How do you feel about the progress that has or hasn't been made?
Well, there are two things here. One is that I'm still extremely disappointed with the tone, actually from both sides, because if you're a Democrat, as I am, we lost the vote. It's now Brexit. And it should be that all parties are working to damage, limitate, and to get the best possible deal. Now, there seems to be coming from many quarters, from businesses, from the civil servants, from the lawyers that I've been speaking to, saying the government still appear to have no clue what they're doing. They don't seem to have alighted on the legal realities of what's required as we move forward. And that the negotiated tone being adopted over both sides are not very helpful. Now, that has got to change, because we have no time. And actually, if it comes to late October, November, December, and we haven't settled phase one, then we really, really are in a difficult situation here. And to my mind, the only solution would be to ask that we extend the 2-year period of negotiations. but also the infighting that's going on in the political parties at the moment. Both political parties is a total and utter disgrace. This is a momentous occasion, Brexit, that's going to change the future of our country for generations to come. And yet the infighting that's going on means that the people will pay is ordinary people. You know, Brexit is not some thing that's going to happen and not affect people. You know, elderly, young, you know, education, every part of our lives are going to be affected by this. And the lack of responsibility is an utter, utter disgrace.
Speaking of infighting, actually, have you read Boris Johnson's Daily Telegraph article that stirred up a lot of controversy very recently?
Absolutely. And I think, you know, one of the things maybe we could do as a very quick win in politics is that if somebody has been found guilty of breaking the code of ethics and lying or, you know, massaging the truth, then as with the legal, the medical profession, I think they should be struck off. So I do not understand why Mr. Johnson and Mr. Gove have anything to do with politics. That we need to get rid of these chances as I see them. This is not what our country needs. And I think, it is so distracting for what's going on. We have a prime minister. They should be holding this government to account, but we should also let them go and negotiate Brexit. We do not have the time. And the damage it is causing to our reputation around the world. You know, we are almost a laughing stock now. Britain, that was seen as being fair, organized, you know, intelligent, we're just a laughing stock.
For those of our listeners who might not have read Boris Johnson's article, could you give me a bit of a summary of sort of the points that you took from it?
One of the things for him to be challenging the Prime Minister's authority and not to be pulling everyone in one direction is a disgrace. But then to revisit the 350 million figure and somehow come up with it and you know, to revisit a lie, two wrongs don't make a right, but to revisit the lie and reposition it in a way that you've got the, you know, head of national statistics, and you've got independent people such as think tanks like a fiscal independent experts like Paul Johnson saying that this number is rubbish. The number he is saying is rubbish. And you cannot say, I intended on making it nuanced so people understood. People are not going to read something and nuance it. It was totally irresponsible. I do not understand why Boris Johnson is there, and Mrs. May should be sacking him immediately.
Do you think that there might be a bit of a tendency of comparing British politics to American politics, especially right now? But I think quite interesting that there's, as we just talked about, a lot of infighting in the parties here and also in America. Do you think that somehow this sort of division is telling about a particular moment in Western politics right now?
I think we're all Western culture and politics have seen a rise of populism, both in my view, because they're based on economic models that have not delivered to everybody in the population and have left an awful lot of people suffering. But when it comes to politics, I think the similarity with both America and the UK is that we have descended into politics of prejudice, where it's about blaming somebody else and it's about picking on other people. And it is very divisive. And it is negative politics, not positive politics. And both leaders seem to have forgotten that they're there to do what's best for our country and for the people in our country, not for themselves and to keep themselves in power. So we have we have professional politicians who will do anything to defend their jobs and their power base. And that will be at the detriment of the country and the people. And that is shameful. And I'm afraid that's what's happened in Western culture and Western politics.
On a more personal and positive note, you are writing a memoir called Rise. And I was wondering whether you could already give me a bit of a hint of what story you're trying to tell with that.
Over the last 18 months or so, because, you know, people think I've Brexit somehow, I've come from nowhere. And yes, it's a sort of been a defining moment, but it has not put me on a platform that I wasn't on before. I have spent the last 10 years as a very activist, transparency activist in the world of the city post the financial crisis and the third sector. So I've been very vocal for things that I see are opaque or lacking scrutiny and governance and transparency. So, in that time, over my last decade or so, as a woman of color, I've experienced a lot, both good and bad. And I'm hoping that through my story and dipping in and out to some of my experiences, I can perhaps help other men and women, not just women, to maybe find their own voice and their own confidence to step out of their comfort zone and speak up for what they see as being right or wrong.
So would you call yourself an activist?
I think I would. I've come to the conclusion that when you don't follow the footpath of others and you are willing to ask maybe uncomfortable questions because you think that others won't, then there is a level of activism there.
I think you've definitely found a sort of way outside of what's the standard realm of how people might be politically active through, for example, the court case that you brought to really make your voice heard. Do you think some people, I think a lot of people struggle with finding a way somehow. They have all these opinions and ways in which they think things might be better, but they don't know how to get to that place. They don't know what means they can use, or they just don't have a way. What tips would you have for them?
I would say it starts small in that, you start at work or in your group and you speak up, and then courage builds courage. So the first time you do it and you're courageous, then it's easier to repeat that and to repeat it in a wider environment. So, for me, it started with speaking up when I was young, and then when I had my eldest daughter and she got special needs and I took on the National Health Service, and then my place of work because of prejudice, and then my relationship. So it hasn't come from nowhere. It wasn't sort of a just one moment. It's a years and years of a little bit of bravery that then makes you braver and brave. And I think it starts small. And I say to people, speak up in a small way and then find the courage to then speak up and again, and you'll find that your voice is louder and that your confidence grows as well as your voice.
Do you think that's especially important to do for women and people of color at the moment, because we're generally more underrepresented in these kind of areas?
I think it is, but I don't think it's exclusively. I mean, there is, in my view, there's too much concentration on just women, gender. I think, there is discrimination and inequality in all sorts of ways, socioeconomic groups, which school you went to. I don't think it is, to my mind, there is too much focus on just females and women discrimination. I think it's much wider than that. But I think each individual has to stand up. But it is difficult to do when you are being forever knocked down. And one of the things I say is that you have to not care too much what other people think about you. Don't worry too much about being liked. If you think what you're saying is right and you've done your homework and you're centered in your view, then you should have the confidence to speak up. But that whole idea, going back to your question about women, is this thing about wanting to be liked. You don't need to be liked.
That's a very wise thing to say, but I think it's also very hard to somehow get over that. As a personally speaking, clearly as a woman, I find it hard to shake something like that. How did you do that?
Because to comfort yourself, when you're at work or you're in your workplace, there are those people around you who are there to pick you up and to give you that big hug to make you feel better. And it's discovering. For me, it's two or three girlfriends who are the cornerstone of my life and my family. So you need those around you who will, give you the comfort that you need. But when you go to work or you step out and you're doing your job and your role or whatever your position is in the world, that is, you don't need to be liked in those situations. You have other people who will love you and like you.
And that's all the Brexit news we have for you today. Do check back on Thursday and next week, as always, for any more Brexit news and opinions that you might need. I've been your host, Jennifer Han, here with my co-host, Tim Hemming, who is also my co-producer on the show, along with Warren Paul. Our theme song is brought to you by Kevin MacLeod, and we hope you'll be joining us again soon.